This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 6th of October, 1956. The title of this lecture is Youth, Today's Displaced Person. This lecture is 66 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
How are all you bright people today? All right, good. Now, you're going along all right, but I'm not, actually. As I told you, I had a very good program all arranged, and I left it home yesterday, and I left it home again today. And that's very difficult, you know. And so I ask Eileen to grab up some papers or something of the sort in a rush, you know, and throw them together so I would be sure and have something to talk to you about. And she did, and she brought me a book, and she brought me this stuff here, and I started looking it over. I started looking it over, and as a matter of fact, I'm overwhelmed. Do we know this much? So I actually said, well, it's at least HCO bulletin here and all that. And it said theory and practice, and it said games, conditions, and re-stimulation and separating valences and the best processes for it. And I looked over here, and there's another HCO bulletin that it says gives a full procedure for staff auditors. And I looked over here, and can I talk to you about children or something? I tell you, it's the subject's getting too much for me, to tell you the truth. Another thing that's very terrible, something that's very terrible that's happening lately, is we have already started to use up our backlog of preclears. That's very bad. There are only 2 billion people here on Earth, and you start chewing into this number of people, you know, even a small amount, and you reduce your havingness. And lately we've been bringing people in and processing them. We process them in Washington. We process them here. And we've been bringing them in, and they've been sitting down talking to the registrar when they left, and they were satisfied. They didn't want any more processing. They thought they could go do things now. So, as I say, that's the inevitable has begun. We are going now to chew into our residual headiness. Now, there are some mechanisms today. We thought there were some very good ones in World War II, but there are some mechanisms today for the disposal of our peculiar and particular type of haddingness, which are, I'm told, very, very efficient. Very efficient. I'm told that they can set off bombs in Australia and make people sick in England now. That's getting pretty efficient. Pretty efficient. And so we've been trying to figure out how to go about this, how to do something about this, to keep our havingness from being run down. Because actually it's only 2 billion or 2.5 billion people, some small figure like this. And if they go and knock off 750 million of these, or I don't know what the optimum casualty rate is for the usual atomic scientist, I think he thinks that he's lived if his bomb knocks off 1 million, I think. I think he feels that he has done his bit. But whatever that rate is, we'll have to cut that down too. And we feel that atomic scientists ought to be satisfied with one person, not 1 million. We think he's being a hog. And we think he should be satisfied with just one person, himself. Now, that, of course, isn't getting us anywhere today. I'm just stalling, as you can see. I actually did. I looked that over, and I said, good heavens, are we that clever now? And you knew people who just came down here to see this fellow Hubbard in this Congress and that sort of thing. You're out of luck. I mean, I start in on that technical material, and it says this, and it says that, and it says something else, and I don't understand it myself. How can you expect to understand it? Because I wrote it. Well, I was talking about our havingness. I don't know what the census figures are. Maybe 2 billion people, maybe 2.5 billion, whatever it happens to be. If you will notice, there is a death rate. People keep dying out of the world and getting born into it. And the death rate, of course, is replaced by the birth rate. Now, we have a difficulty here in thetans. I don't know what the allocation of thetans are to Earth at this time, but it's pretty close to one for one. I know there are some of you who go around the society who doubt this. I know that particularly when we go down to a police precinct or something like that, we're sure that it's wrong. That there are people there who don't have thetans. But that's not true. They all have thetans. Some keep them in their pockets and some in their wallets. They have them. Because they've been dished out and they are accountable for them at the end of the run. They check them over when they come off the train and they say, "Have you got your thetan?" And the fellow says, "Yes, yes." Now, for those of you that are brand new in Scientology, thetan is a meaningless term. Completely meaningless. It does happen, however, that some Scientologists think it does have a meaning. And this is just delusion, of course. We used to have a great deal of exteriorization. We don't have that anymore. We got almost everybody out. As a matter of fact, speaking of thetans, it's quite amusing to note that the process which we use today to get the preclear into session and more or less under control, which is a process known as SCS, exteriorizes people more easily than any other process we ever had. And it's just something that starts a session. That's how relatively unimportant this whole thing of exteriorization is today. It's quite amusing. We took a chap who had never heard of Scientology. His boss told him to go get audited, so he obediently reported to the Hazi. And he was busy walking up and down through this process known as SCS. And all of a sudden, he came out of his head. Well, you understand, this individual was a business person. This individual was not, you might say, one of the flightier types. He was solid. He believed in everything being heady. He believed in things you could put your hands on. He believed in facts being facts. And I think, by the way, his field was accounting. And the auditor started him into SCS. Well, now, SCS is an interesting process. I'll just give you some of these little processes here. You might find some use for them at some time or another. And you tell somebody, "Now we're going to run a little drill on you called Start the Body. And you're going to stand here, and I'm going to stand here, and we're going to ask you to start the body when I say start." And you say, "All right, start the body." And he starts walking. You say, "That's fine." Well, he expects you to tell him to stop. He usually walks into a wall or some chairs or something. You never do tell him to stop because you're running start. He finally comes off of it and realizes that you have executed the command no matter what he's doing now. You bring him back again. You say, "All right, now start the body." And he moves off. And this time he's smart. He doesn't run into so many things. And you say, "Fine, fine, that's good, that's fine." You take a hold of him, turn him around again. You say, "All right, now once more, I'm going to give you this little practice. And when I say start the body, you start the body." And he does, you see. Well, that's start. Now, the next one is change. And you mark out 4 points on the floor, A, B, C, and D, and you put the preclear on one of these points, point A, and you say, now we're going to run a little drill known as change the body. And when I ask you to change the body, I want you to change the body's position from this point A over here to this point B. Now, can you do that? And he says, oh, sure, that's nothing easier. And so you put him on A, and you say, all right, now change the body. And he immediately changes the body's position over to B, or he doesn't, as the case may be, depending on the preclear. And you run that for a while. That's just change. Now we get to stop. That's the remaining S. And we say, now we're going to run a little drill known as stop the body. And we have a preclear here, and we say, now we're going to get the body moving in that direction. When I say stop, why, you stop the body, all right? And he said, that's fine. So we pat him on the back, and he gets the body moving, and we wait for a moment, and we say stop. And he stops the body, or he doesn't, as the case may be. And we then say to him, now, did you stop the body, you see? He tells you dishonestly that he stopped the body for the first 15 or 20 times, and then finally he does get some inkling of actually putting the brakes on. Up to that time, it's the auditor that's stopping the body. That's for sure. Well, that's stop. Well, now we have start, change, and stop, and they are simply run as a little drill of walking somebody around a room. Now, why do we run start, change, and stop? Why do we run these three things? Because they are the anatomy of control. An individual who cannot control a body isn't even worth scrap meat in this society. That's for sure. These fellows who drive automobiles down the road and can't stop them, can't start them, can't change them, without curbs or lights telling them, you know, they are a liability. They are the people who give you the automobile accidents. Now, the accident prone is a more complicated subject than this, but just as an example, an individual who has lots of things happen to him has them happen because of miscalculations. He isn't competent, actually, in controlling the body. And his incompetence results in injuries. That's just one little example. Now, what do you think that a ballet dancer has to do in the way of controlling the body? It's rather fabulous, isn't it? The amount of gyration and sudden start and stop that has to be accomplished in doing ballet. Now, here we have, however, to your first view, a very complex subject, controlling the body. But it really breaks down to just three things. Just three things: starting it, changing it, and stopping it. Now, we don't care whether you changed it by making it go in a circle or doing a backflip. That was a change of position, wasn't it? A guided change, you might say. And that is all there is to it. It's merely a change of position. And you have to start a body to get it into motion so that you can change it. And if you have changed it, you have to be able to stop it. And that's all there is to control. I don't care whether you're controlling an IBM calculator or any other kind of a mechanism, whether you're controlling a body, whether you're controlling a dog, whether you're controlling a policeman or a government. You're running simply nothing but start, change, and stop. If you want to put somebody under control, it is really only necessary to keep stopping them for a while, and they, to some degree, come under control. All wives know this. The husband, for instance, he starts in, and he says, dear, you know your hat bill for last month. And she says, just a moment, dear, the coffee is boiling. Well, he sits there, and he sits down at the table, and he says, now, dear, about your hat bill last month, just a moment, John, I want to talk to the maid about cleaning the front room. After a while, he doesn't mention the hat bill, which is an optimum condition. Now, we look at that at first glance, and we simply say she has merely stopped him from talking about a hat bill. But if this were all there was to it, there wouldn't be any marriages. The fact of the matter is, by having stopped him, she eventually controls him on the subject of hats.
Just by exercising stop, she now could go out and buy 12 more hats. And this time he would say, dear, this has got to stop. And she'd say, what, dear? The hats, the buying of the hats. He would say, just a moment, dear, I want to speak to the maid. Now, he said, that gag's gone far enough. Far enough. You've avoided, that's all he thinks she's doing, see? You've avoided this issue about these hats. And now I'm going to talk to you about them here and now. Now, she's a very, very clever wife. She has intercepted his memos to his stenographer or something of the sort. And she says at this moment, that reminds me, dear, there is another matter I would like to take up with you. There's this matter of these notes I found to your secretary. Now, the truth of the matter is this isn't what it appears to be, you see. It isn't just a matter of making somebody halt. If you make somebody stop enough, you control them. She could go from having stopped him several times into changing him and into starting him. Just as simple as that. Now, what do you think these traffic lights do to a motorist? Do they just stop him? No, they don't. Stop is part of SCS. Start, change, and stop. And every time a motorist is stopped by a light against his will, but is nevertheless stopped, to that degree he goes under the control of the state. And pretty soon the state can change and start him. It's very simple. I don't mean to tell you that the traffic lights are the sole cause of police states. I don't mean just because we're regulating traffic that we are eventually going to get everything under very beautiful control. You see, this would only happen if there wasn't this wild variable called a theta around. If everything was stimulus response perfectly, it would inevitably occur that the state would then completely control somebody. It would inevitably occur that the wife, by stopping her husband at every time that he tried to mention the hat bill, would then, you see, come under complete control of the husband. You'd have one of these invariable inevitabilities if man was a machine. But man doesn't happen to be a machine. Sooner or later, he decides that the control is too much. He recognizes it for what it is. He recognizes that he no longer has the right to control his own life. And he always starts a revolution, or he hires four more secretaries, or he does something. That's because the only type of control which is workable is the type we know about in Scientology. We say, when I say stop, you stop the body. You have this. It's you stop the body. Now, what do you mean by you? A thetan, a spirit, a being, the fellow the preclear really is. He stops the body. This simple, nothing to it. So, if we said this way, we would have this very nicely grooved with the military services. By the way, have you ever had anything to do with the military services? They're very interesting organizations. They require and they really demand an awful lot of study. There's nothing more military than a military service, I've often said. Somebody asked me the other day, well, what if everything was nationalized? What if everything was nationalized? Some chap here in the government. What would be wrong with that? Well, it said there'd be nothing wrong with everything being nationalized except just one little thing. And that is, there wouldn't be any you to control anything. It would all be done by the government, and it's not a thetan. Oh, he said, that sounds rather strange, rather peculiar. His machines run. I said, yes, but there's always somebody there in front of the machine to press the buttons. Oh, no, there's machines that run and press their own buttons. Well, there's somebody always was there to press the buttons which caused the chain reaction of the machine pressing the buttons. Defeated him. He said, but there's always somebody in government who is interested. I'm sure there is, but there's another you, another individual. And if you de-individualized the world and made it impossible for anyone to have a reward for his own endeavors at all, there'd be nobody interested in punching any buttons. They'd all go play golf or something. Unless, of course, we could exercise a complete positive control. Machine fashion. And if that was possible with man, that's what we have to ask. Is it possible with man? It's theoretical, but is it possible? Has it ever happened? No, the most arduous conqueror on earth was never able to put all of his troops, all of the time, under total control. There was always a wild variable. There was always you that suddenly had the power of choice, or felt he should have the power of choice. There was always somebody to get out of line. I had a friend one time wrote a little short story, which was quite interesting, science fiction story, a chap named Paul Ernst. And the story was named, He Didn't Like Soup. And we have this beautifully geared up, gorgeous, chromium-plated society. Sky cars and underpasses and double passes and floating palaces and so on. Fellow gets into this by time travel from 1935, when the story was written. He gets into it. They put him in a lineup. He said, what are we doing here? All these very regimented people, you know, very robot fashion. They said, this is where we eat. And he said, oh, good. We're in the chow hall. Fine. He said, what's this? They said, well, that's the endless belt the dishes come along on, and when your dish comes along, why, you take your plate off. You sit down over here and you eat. Good. Nice system. So the endless belt started rolling, and the plates of soup started coming along. Plates of soup all came along. Everybody took off his plate of soup and went over and sat down at the table and started to eat soup. And this fellow stood there with his friends, and they picked up their soup, and he went over to the table with them, and they looked at him and said, where's your soup? He says, I don't like soup. At this moment, at the end of the endless belt, there was a horrible crash. He'd never taken his soup off of the endless belt. Well, that jammed just one conveyor system. But finally, because one conveyor system jammed, the whole civilization went by the boards. The whole thing crashed. It couldn't help but crash because he didn't like soup. Into a totally regimented society, one man with an untampered power of choice decided not at some given instant to do something, you see. There'd always be somebody time-traveling or somebody teleporting or somebody exteriorizing or some Hubbard that comes along and tells people, don't be a robot. There's always some kind of thing happens, you see, to these well-oiled machines. They take care of them these days in the United States Army very easily. They turn them over to a psychiatrist. I don't know who they're going to turn the psychiatrist over to after a while, but they'll have to turn him over to somebody if they're turning over all of the self-determined people in the United States Army to psychiatrists. You can see what a horrible plot that poses. I can see one of them accidentally asking the right question one day of a psychiatrist. You know? Why is it, he will say, the repetition of it's a boy, it's a boy, it's a boy, makes people have colds? He will ask this male psychiatrist. Psychiatrists say, why is it? What are you talking about? Well, I don't know, he says, but why is it if you say it's a boy, it's a boy, it's a boy, that you get a cold? I wonder why that is. Psychiatrist will say, you know, this is not a standard interview I'm having here. And there will go this beautiful system by which every person who gets out of line in the United States Army is turned over to a psychiatrist, because there won't be any psychiatrists left. The psychiatrist will go into the mess hall and start repeating, it's a boy, it's a boy, it's a boy, and he'll come down with pneumonia. And somebody will try to figure out why that happened, and nobody will be smart enough to go back and get at the same place this Army recruit got it, Dianetics. So here is this interruption of the perfect stimulus response mechanism. Now, some people say that's very bad. A mechanism should always be perfect stimulus response. That is the optimum mechanism. That is the thing we should have. All people at all times should like soup. You see? That's perfect. Only in that way can we have a perfect society. Now, there's only one difficulty with this. If everybody was in a stimulus response condition, you would have machines which were simply running machines. And one day a machine would break down, and even though you had other machines that were supposed to repair the machines that broke down, someday the repairing machine would break down and somebody would have to make a decision. Somebody would have to create something. Somebody would have to change something that was not in the original plans. And when that moment occurred, they would need an individual. And if they didn't have one, the whole society would perish right there. So you might say in government, you pays your money and you takes your chance. You give them enough stimulus response machinery and hope that not too many individuals will result. And hope that people stay in line somehow. This is the hope, you might say, of government. Somewhere along the line, they have always felt man being evil. That is always the assumption in their calculations, which they have never noticed. Man being evil can no longer be gotten into line. And then we will have a difficulty. We will have a raw-red revolution. The revolutionary standing up and telling everybody about strawberries. You know, the revolutionary is talking to everybody, big mass meeting, and he says, "When comes the revolution, everybody have strawberries." Somebody in the audience says, "I don't like strawberries." He says, "When comes the revolution, you'll like strawberries." This I would call a species of giddy optimism. Now, if everybody was evil, then it would be necessary for us to have stimulus response mechanisms. If the possession of a power of choice was bad, then it would be very bad for people to have a power of choice. And then the only thing you could have would be a machine society. Do you follow that, Carol? But supposing something else was the case, supposing that it was only suppression into stimulus response that made man bad. My goodness, wouldn't that upset the calculation? That calculation would be very, very upset at that time. Supposing the effort to put men under duress turned them bad. And if you made them not halfway free, but if you made them free to think, to be, and to have a power of choice, it turned out that they all felt that men were fine. That'd be a fantastic experience, for instance, for a drill sergeant. He's been... Now, get the difference between SCS and a drill sergeant's action. Drill sergeant says, "Halt!" And they go up 2, 3, 4, 8, 9, 12 to the rear march or whatever they do when they halt. That just shows you the whole army's gone into apathy. You can measure the length of apathy that armies have gone into by how many steps they take after the sergeant says, "Halt." Early armies used to halt at once. The American army takes two steps. Some of the older guards companies have lost count. But you take a lot of steps after somebody says halt. You do a lot of things with your feet. Well, now, they just had too many recruits take that extra step, and they finally succumbed to it, you see. But get the singular difference. They are saying, "When I say halt, halt."
And if you don't halt,
guard houses, private interviews with the captain. You get the idea. Bad conduct discharges, punishment, duress. See? And when they say halt to an army company, why, it normally halts. Now, there have been some companies that have been far, far too well trained. Somebody once asked the difference between an army company, a navy division, and a squad of Marines. And it was explained to them that this was very apparent in their close order drill. The Navy fellows, you line them up against the end of the dock, and they had about 20 feet between them and the edge in the water. These Navy chaps, you'd say, all right, forward march, you see, right toward the water. Navy fellows would get within about 5 feet of it and turn around and look at, what the hell do you think you're doing? You know? The naval reaction to this. The Army boys, they'd walk right up there, and right when they met the edge, they'd just start marking time. Marine Corps, right on in. Interesting states of discipline. One of the great military conquerors of all time in the Western world was a conqueror at a period, by the way, when there wasn't very much to conquer. Everything was sort of knocked in. And this chap did an awfully good job conquering. But as I say, there wasn't very much to conquer at that time, it being around the 560-70 A.D. That was Belisarius, Count Belisarius, Justinian's general. He conquered everything in sight, and he ran out of things to conquer, and he didn't have much imagination. But he was probably a much greater general than Napoleon ever was, but he just lacked the opportunities. This fellow Belisarius always took with him, this sounds very fantastic, but he really did, always take with him several divisions of sailors, because he might want something done. That's fantastic. He dragged them all over land. Because they hadn't been disciplined to a point where they couldn't think. Quite important, you see. Terribly important. Nobody ever dreams of drilling sailors very much anyhow. There's not much space. Now, the army says, halt. And it's the sergeant that halts them, and the troops know that it's the sergeant that halts them. And they know who's stopping that body, the sergeant. But in SCS, which, by the way, runs out more marching, you get somebody who's been in the army and you run SCS on them for quite a while and you just run out all of their marching. They feel much better after a while. They find very amusing. You ought to see some of these chaps that have had long, arduous military service run this process known as SCS. They come to the end of the line and go, halt, two, three, or whatever it is. You say, do you find that necessary? Do you have to do that? Oh, stop it. The fellow says, well, yes, that's the way you stop a body. One, two. After a while, he gets it down to two and then one and then is able to stop the body. And why are you changing it? Well, you're changing it for a very subtle reason, a very, very subtle reason. You stop the body, you say. Now, the auditor isn't trying to get precision. He isn't trying to get snap there at first. He's trying to get assurance across to the preclear that he can stop the body, and he's trying to make very certain that it is the preclear who is stopping the body. So he might very early in this give him some admonition, like, I don't care how many paces you walk after I say stop. You just make very sure that it's you that stops it. You make sure that it is you who does this action. And you very often find a fellow will loaf along for two or three, four or five more steps. And then he'll stop the body. When he gets good, he himself can do it. so fast after you say stop that he practically holds the body in thin air. And he makes the decision. Now, why is it that a drill sergeant guffs around, or I don't know, what is basic training developed into now, 10 or 12 years? He goofs around with troops. We don't consider troops seasoned troops unless they've been around for an awfully long time. How is he having so much trouble stopping them, starting them, and changing them? Why is he having this much trouble? It's the simplest thing in the world. He never says, "And when I give the command, halt, each private soldier shall thereupon stop his body." You look up in army manuals, I mean factually, you'll never find this. And that's why it takes him 6 years to wear down an organization to a point where it will halt with precision. And when you say you do it, why, it takes a good auditor less than an hour to get somebody into perfect military form. He isn't even trying to get them military form, but he certainly does. You could take the average person, and with SCS, not trying anything fancy with it, not using it therapeutically, stop CS is the therapeutic version of this. This is just a control version. Why is it that within an hour, he can do 6 years of drill? And why is it that when he does this, remember, this fellow in the military did this just thousands and thousands and thousands of times and still kept the habit pattern, still kept the nice little machine that when the sergeant said halt, he halted. And why is it in the course of an hour the auditor just runs this whole trading pattern right straight out of the preclear, swish? What is the difference? It's you stop the body. It's taking into account the fact that beings are composed of bodies, minds, and thetans, and is requesting the cooperation of the thetan in the execution of the command. And if a society supposes that everybody is so brainless and so stupid that everybody in it has to be totally regulated, they are not consulting with the item that has a power of choice in the first place. And eventually they wipe out any idea of the existence of a power of choice or a spirit. They start educating their people along these lines. If you read this chapter enough and memorize these words well enough, you will then know the whole subject of engineering. They send the boy forth and they say, "All right, now build a bridge." He'll simply stand there. He won't build any bridge. He wouldn't know how to build a bridge. Now, where does he fall down? He's been made to study his cooperation. Remember, he is a thetan. He is a being who is running a body. And his cooperation was never invited. If you invited the cooperation of a child in study, you probably could wash up his schoolwork in 2 or 3 years. Very easily. And I don't know, in America, it's getting more and more lengthened. And I think they're, according to present plans, they're going to get out of high school at 35 or something. And college at 52. If they keep going the way they're going. That's because educational methods of the stimulus-response variety. See, here is a page of text. Now, if you can regurgitate it onto an examination paper, you pass. And they call this training. See, it's not training at all. The individual has to be able to understand that page and resynthesize it entirely. But if he sees no purpose in doing so, he won't. So you have to, this is a horrible thing, you put this off on teachers. You have to tell children what spelling is for, what arithmetic is for. You have to tell them a good purpose to put writing to. You see, you have to invite their cooperation. You have to say, this is why we're teaching you to do these things. And now you figure out a good way to go about doing them. And the next thing you know, you'd have given somebody a complete education in a very few years. Why? Because you've invited them to cooperate in your activity. You haven't sized up everybody as a stimulus response machine. Well, now I'll tell you something horrible. I've been talking here as though it were possible to train a human being as a stimulus response mechanism. I've just been, you know, giving a break to the educational and world authorities of today. They all believe this is possible, so I've been agreeing with them just to be nice. But I really have to be very factual with you. I don't see any reason to agree with them at all because I have no slightest evidence that stimulus response training is possible in a man. I haven't any evidence that this is ever feasible. Dogs, yes. Dog, yes, he's totally reactive. You say to a dog, bark, he'll bark. If he doesn't bark, you beat him until he does bark, and then you say, that's a good dog, and pat him on the head. See? Now, you can more or less handle dogs this way. You can probably handle rats this way, although they're smarter. Undoubtedly, you could handle most government leaders this way, but you can't handle human beings this way, that's all. Now, even amongst dogs, there's a tremendous amount of randomity. And it's really only apparent that the dog is a stimulus response machine. I put this to test one time. A famous dog trainer was busy training dogs for everybody that came along. And I got a hold of one of his dogs, inherited one of his dogs. Dog looked at me. I looked at the dog. I noticed something about the dog that nobody had noticed before. He wasn't cheerful. His emotional tone left much to be desired. So I said to the dog, I said, what's the matter with you? And he looked at me. There ensued a conversation in which he said, well, I've had hell trained out of me. And I don't know whether I'm going or coming because I've gotten to a point where I can't handle this body anymore. But the body responds to certain responses that other people give it. So I'm irresponsible now. I bite people. And he says, I'm very astonished at myself. I just keep biting people. Person comes down the street. There I am with my teeth in him. So I wish I could do something about it. I've talked to myself about it. But he says, unfortunately, my body has been trained to do guard duty. So I said, this is a heck of a note. What'll I do for this dog? And I skipped the whole thing. I said, Too much trouble. I've got too much to do. Dog went over next door and killed everybody's chickens. That costs money. Went down to a farm across the road and killed all the chickens down there. I got a hold of the dog and I said, what's the matter with you? He said, I don't know. He says, I'm irresponsible. He said, when I see a chicken, my body bites it. He said, I've been trained to do guard duty. So in view of the fact that both he and I by that time had become social problems, I decided I had better work this dog for about 15 minutes a day and see what I could do. And I got a hoop. Dog looked at the hoop and said, that looks awfully undignified. I said, well, I don't care whether it's undignified or not. I bet you can't jump through it. He says, never been trained to. And I said, well, there it is, and we'll play with it here for 15 minutes, and you're getting 15 minutes worth of attention from me, remember? He says, I am. That's right. Next day, the dog jumped through the hoop. Never saw the like of it. Jumped through the hoops up here, jumped through down here, jumped through over here. I didn't train him. I says, here's a hoop, and for the first day we played tug-of-war with a hoop. And then I said, you know, that way a couple of times, and dog said to me, you know, I can make this body jump through that. I said, good. Next day, why, we had that trick. Why go on with that one? So I took a stick, you know, fetch a stick. We got that one through with in about 3 minutes. You know, he'd fetch a stick. So he could fetch a stick, you know, so what? I said, well, you're getting some attention. He said, that's right. But he says, you know, this is awfully dull. You throw a stick. I can make my body do that now. And I said, well, that's all right, fine. I know. You take the stick in your mouth and jump through the hoop. Oh, he says, too complicated. I said, oh, come on, you can do that. I says, well, it's nothing to me. I said, if you don't want to jump through the hoop, you don't want to jump through the hoop. And I petted him, and we played with the ball for a little while, and that was that. And the dog sat there and thought this over. He thought that over all the rest of the afternoon. He thought that over all evening. He was sitting in the same place the next morning. You talk about a comm lag. I came back, proper time, and I said, here's the hook, there's the stick, what you going to do about it? Oh, hell, he says. I can make my body do that. And I says, well, that's fine. You know, eventually the dog ran me out. He ran me out entirely. He got to a point, I could teach him to do a quintuple trick on one signal. You know, he'd go through five different evolutions on one signal. And I just ran out of tricks. I just didn't have any more tricks. I mean, I couldn't think of any more tricks. Had him turning on and off light bulbs, had him filling the wood box, had him doing everything but clean my boots. And by that time, we were practically having conversations on Nietzsche and things like that anyhow. So funny part of it was the dog stopped killing chickens and stopped being antisocial. But that dog had been trained by a very famous dog trainer. All I did was untrain him. So we can't even thoroughly say that a dog is totally a stimulus response mechanism. Cats, they're different. Although I've had a lot of cats around that... it's quite interesting, by the way, what happens to a cat if you process him. That's right. You can process animals. Very easy to do. You run Dianetics old time. I had one cat that I trained to get even with editors with. And I trained the cat so that he'd get even with editors for me, you see. It was a cooperative endeavor. This was a Dianetic cat. When I wrote Dianetics, Modern Science and Mental Health, the cat used to lie on the bed alongside of my typewriter and lie on top of the manuscript. And I'd pull a new sheet out of the stack and put it through the typewriter, push it over, and want to put it down on the other stack. Cat would lift its paw. I just did that for practically every sheet that was written on Dianetics, Modern Science and Mental Health. You know, cheerful, companionable, liked to hear the typewriter purr. It was an electric typewriter, and it purred, and I suppose he had this confused with himself or something. But anyhow, not even this cat was a good stimulus response example. This cat, stimulus response, would wash its face and do other things, but actually it was a rather timid cat to begin with. And I decided one day that one too many editors had come in and booted it. You know, it'd be lying in front of the fireplace or on a nice, comfortable chair, and an editor, being a privileged character, would come in and push the cat out of the road, you see, and sit down alongside the fireplace. And I decided this. It was a usurpation of inviolable franchise. And so I'd get the cat and process the cat in this wise. Here'd be the cat, and I would put a little shoelace in front of the cat. And every time the cat would bat at the shoelace, I would pull the shoelace back. First, the cat was very timid. Shoelace, you know, didn't work. Pretty soon, you know, get that paw out there to get that shoelace, you know. Next thing you know, I'd put on a heavy glove. And I'd put my hand up near the cat, and every time the cat would make the tiniest motion toward the glove, I would withdraw. Slightly. Not so fast as to alarm the cat, but enough to lead him. Boy, I got his anchor points out there about 8 miles. Editor used to come in, sit down comfortably alongside of the fireplace. Cat would go up and take a look at his shoelaces. Lovely example of one-one-ism on my part. Anyway, the cat became very combative. Once the cat had become combative, the cat started to hunt, the cat started to scramble around and develop these other little odds and ends of tricks, such as lying on my manuscripts while I was writing and lifting its paw so I could put down a sheet. So. Animals that are processed seem to indicate that not all thetans are allocated human bodies. In fact, I ran into a horse once that had been a lady in his last life. He certainly was a peculiar horse. He just would not listen to reason. And any male rider that came near, why, that was the end of that ride. Bang. But nevertheless, was a very, very nice, clever horse. Providing one wanted the horse to be clever. That if you tried to be stimulus response with this horse, you had a bad horse. I don't know whether man or horses or anything else can be punished into doing things on a stimulus response basis. And I don't know that there is any real evidence anywhere in existence that punishment or duress has ever trained anybody to do anything. I don't know if there's any evidence that just total stimulus response has ever trained anybody to do anything. See, I'm not at all sure this is the case. Now, that is a complete reversal. That is a complete reversal of the most cherished and fondest held beliefs on the part of education and government in the world today. That's an unfortunate reversal. Without the ingredient of cooperation from the individual, all such training activities are doomed to failure. Without some cooperation, and all you have in the final analysis is the person's willingness. If stimulus response in its totality does not work, then let me assure you that it never works. It just never works. The thing that does work is the willingness of the individual. That works. In other words, all that anybody has in terms of a worker is the willingness of the worker to work. It puts an awfully different look at an awful lot of things. If that is blunted, you have nothing left. If you blunt the willingness to cooperate, there is nothing else there. Now remember that there is a willingness to play a game. There is a willingness to have a certain set of rules to abide by. That's all part of the game. There is a willingness to have barriers. If you assume at once that there is no willingness to have a game, then you have assumed a completely untenable point. An individual does want something to do. He is willing then to do a great deal to have something to do. But it's that willingness to play a game, that willingness to be there, that willingness to serve, that is the total riches that one has, whether he's training a dog or a horse or a man or anything else. There's nothing else. And when that willingness is gone, you have nothing. Now let's look at preclears. Preclears are willing to be processed. But when they become unwilling to be processed, there's nothing there. You can't process them under duress. Now the funny part of it is that we are doing something to which they should apply a willingness. And all we have to do is demonstrate that our intentions are good and that we wish to invite their willingness to be processed, and we break through that unwillingness to be processed. There is the where an auditor makes a case entrance. He brings into being a willingness to be processed. And then he makes that grow. And the individual then becomes willing not only to be processed, but to live and to do all sorts of things. And so, when we examine industry, when we examine this rather weird activity called labor and management, you know, labor and management are never at war. They're never at war. If you can show me one person in a factory who isn't managing something, I will show you some labor. But at no time have I ever found anybody in a factory who wasn't managing something. I don't care. The janitor manages a broom. I will then show you some labor for management to be at war with. Now, I can see how management could be at war with capital. I can see this because the capitalist in olden times simply made money by money. He had some money, so he used the money he had to make more money. He himself never contributed anything but money, which is a rather thin contribution in terms of the total contribution of a society, merely to contribute some stocks and bonds into an venture and then sit back and clip coupons on everybody else's sweat. We can see then, because the capitalist is not a manager. See, he isn't managing anything. He's simply handing out money and clipping the coupons. And that's the pure form of capitalism. Now, a manager or management is doing this, you see. So we have these two things, management, which would extend right on down to the janitor, and capital, it isn't doing anything. And we could conceive then there could be a fight between those two things. That's rather easy for there to be a fight. And actually, there is a tremendous fight between those two things that nobody's really spotted yet. But it is the big fight. So I don't know why I don't know why management doesn't strike against capital. Because capital is as close to a zero as we have on a production line. We say it's important, but that's people being polite so they can borrow some more money. Anyway, the managers of the world keep the world running, not the capitalists. That makes me something or other, I suppose. That probably makes me a raving socialist. I'm a capitalist myself, actually, though. I tipped a fellow 1 and 6 on a cab. Makes me a capitalist. Anyhow, where we have a fight developing in a plant, it isn't because people want more from the plant, really. It isn't because things are going badly in a plant. It's a very simple reason. It's because somebody has blunted their willingness to work. That's all. That's all. And if that is blunted enough, you don't have any production. There are no huge industries. There is no industrial civilization left. All right. Now let's take this stimulus response, if it can get to that magnitude. Let's look over this stimulus response and see if it has anything at all to do with youth and education. Well, the whole subject, you see, becomes very simple if you understand that there is really no such thing as a stimulus response, positive stimulus response mechanism. They're all unreliable. one way or the other. Second, you walk out of the absolute field of machinery, stimulus response becomes unreliable. We see then that wherever youth is denied, wherever his willingness to be part of the society is blunted, wherever his educational impulse is forced back into a stimulus response mechanism, we see then we have lost a valuable citizen. How would we lose all the valuable citizens we have in the world? How would we create a whole generation with no valuable citizens in it? We would simply insist on a stimulus response training and a stimulus response activity on the part of all of its younger members. We would insist that people never learn by reason to avoid hot stoves, that they had to be burned before they avoided stoves. And if we assumed this long enough and often enough and assumed it everywhere, in every sphere of activity, we would wind up with no leaders. We'd wind up with no real worthwhile people. We'd wind up with no doers. We'd wind up with a bunch of slaves with nobody to push the buttons. But would they even be slaves? And there is where the entirety of socialism and communism goes entirely astray. They think that slaves can be created, and they can't. That is the horrible truth behind these great social movements. We see them stumbling, we see them failing. They aren't possible. They are based upon the belief that an individual can be pressed into a stimulus response mechanism, where the fear of punishment, the fear of loss will be so great that he'll then continue to perform. And this is not a possible achievement. Sooner or later, somebody in the crew is going to say, the devil with it. Somebody's going to think a thought. Somebody's going to do something that just spoils the whole works. Somebody is going to turn around to his fellow workers and say, you know, I just noticed something. This mill wheel that we have been pushing against here hasn't had any grain in it for 2 years. And they'll say, huh? Not being used to being talked to. Huh? And he'll say, that's right. He said, look in there. There's no grain in there. We're not grinding anything. We're not getting any. We're just walking here in a circle pushing this wheel. And they look in there and they say, hey, is there supposed to be grain in there? He'll say, that's right. There's supposed to be grain in there. I know, because 2 years ago I remember putting grain in there. Most of them will say, to hell with it. And they all throw off that yoke. And it'll be just another story of he didn't like soup. There will be 6 or 8 workers who are thinking. And if, when man discovers that he's been duped, hell hath no fury like his. When he discovers that he's been used as a machine, but he himself is capable of thought, the violence of his rebellion is greater than the ability of any wall to withstand. It's something like pushing a tremendously strong spring tighter and tighter and tighter down to put men or youth or anyone else under duress. Spring goes down tighter, they push it tighter, and push it tighter, and someday they reach the end of their arm, but the spring isn't totally collapsed. Then what happens? If they so much as wiggle a finger, with a tremendous resounding sprang, out it comes and up it goes. That's why the world to us today appears tense. That's why it appears tense. It has amongst it several societies at this time that have been doing that thing. They've been compressing that spring, and now their arms are out at full extension, and somebody's liable to think a thought. Now, you can take those as revolutionary words, if you will. They sound awfully revolutionary, but they're merely philosophical. This happens to be true. All societies that depend on stimulus response training, all schools that depend on it, all families that depend on stimulus response training, are neglecting the only thing they have there of any value, which is the willingness of the person to participate. The willingness of the person to contribute and to participate. And when they neglect that and specialize on stimulus response, they lose the person, because that's all they have, is somebody with a willingness to participate. And when they no longer have somebody with a willingness to participate, they don't have anything. They have a spring that explodes. Thank you.